It's possible you've heard me talk before about the idea that Bitcoin is a watershed technology and ushering a new golden age of reason, a new era of thought and prosperity, the final renaissance. And I'm so excited today to have somebody on the show who wants to talk about these ideas with me. Cole Walmsley is the CEO and founder of Gator Capital, and someone else who is along for the ride of the monetary revolution transitioning into a broader transformation of how civilization thinks about everything. I'm Scott Deedles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about Bitcoin's role as the catalyst in the final renaissance, stick around. This is one of my favorite episodes. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. Joined by special guest this week, Cole Walmsley. Cole, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Pleasure to be here.
So I have a few different things I want to talk to you about today. Maybe just before we get started, could you give us a little bit of the TLDR of yourself for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. I like to say my journey starts post high school when I decided to forego the college route and move to Jacksonville, Florida from Northern Virginia to go pursue playing poker professionally. And I did that for a little bit, moved in with a couple of people that I had never met before, and also got into investing just before that, which led me to crypto. And then, you know, you learn your lesson there, dabbling in the hoop of that space. And then I found Bitcoin. I actually started doing my own research, started forming my own beliefs, and woke up to the brilliance that is Bitcoin. And yeah, that's the ultimate TLDR, but now we're here.
So I don't like to timestamp these conversations too much, but you were at the Bitcoin conference in Nashville last week. And I noticed you tweeted something that really resonated with me. I had a really similar idea, and I'm just going to read the tweet. You said, and I'm going to preface this before I read it and say, for listeners, we are unabashed Saylor bros. We love Michael Saylor on the Block Reward. But your tweet said, Michael Saylor does not fully understand Bitcoin. He continues to judge the next system with the old system. And it's a reference to Mr. Saylor's presentation. And in that presentation, he's forecasting a Bitcoin price in dollars like way out, all the way out to 2050. So yeah, maybe let's just start there and tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that and the presentation and how you had that reaction.
Yeah, I don't know, because I tried to get into the main stage 2 hours before he spoke. He spoke at 2 p.m. local time. And I got in line at 12 p.m. and me and seven or eight other people got to the end of the line, which was incredibly long. And we got in line and an employee working at the venue came up to us and said, you have literally no chance of getting into the stage. Like, you have no chance. So you can sit here, stay in here for an hour and then just not get in, or you can, you know, do as you please. Do with that what you will. So I said, all right, I'm not going to stay in the line for an hour. So I left, and then I ended up watching it on my own, basically as if I didn't pay for the pass to get in. But I watched the stream and I watched Saylor's speech in full, and I was watching it and I was like, why are we continuing to talk about the dollar like it's the future? Why are we pricing Bitcoin and the dollar in 21 years? And more specifically, and the picture that I used on that post was this big graph of different assets within the global economy. So Bitcoin, I think in 2045, it had like 200 and some odd trillion dollars allocated to it. And then he had money with $550 trillion. And I was like, what's the thesis here? Is Bitcoin suffered from money? No, I certainly don't believe it. I would say most Bitcoiners don't believe that as well. But why are we propagating that narrative? Why is that being discussed at a Bitcoin conference? So I used the cheesy hook tagline that I knew would get people to get to the next sentence, because it's really all hook when I'm writing. But I broke it down. I was like, and I, you know, I've seen it from Saylor before, and I absolutely support what he's doing and love the way he presents himself in the space, and am a believer in MicroStrategy for sure. But I've never really seen him take the position that Bitcoin will be global money. And I've been a little bit confused by that. I've in fact seen him in the days after. I saw some quotes, and one of them was actually right after the interview, or right after the presentation he gave. He did an interview and he said that in order to back the dollar, you use Manhattan. And he was referring to Bitcoin being Cyber Manhattan. So basically, you use Bitcoin to back the dollar. I'm like, what? What is this stand. So then I saw another quote that said, we don't need to replace the euro. We don't need to replace the dollar. And I don't, that's just a quote from a comment. I didn't hear him actually say that. But it continues with this theme that I've seen from him, not really discussing Bitcoin past being a store of value. And I'm like, yeah, the store of value is great, but the end game is it being global money, global unit of account, global money of exchange. So I was kind of, I guess, being kicked out of the line, essentially, and not getting to see it in person, plus watching and still being confused on why he was taking this stance. I wrote that thread or that post and highlighting that it doesn't seem he views it as money. And then, you know, kind of took off on Twitter and had the reply guys come in, and I started learning new things and getting new perspectives. And some people were taking the position of he doesn't want to take the stance that Bitcoin will replace the dollar because that puts a target on his back. And I totally get that. I think that makes a ton of sense. But on the other side, it's like, why are we afraid to present the truth? Is that like straight up? Like, I think there's something going on maybe under the table. I don't know. I don't understand. We should be forthcoming with the truth unabashedly. So it just added to my confusion. And then some people were like, no, he gets it, but he kind of wants to present this sly roundabout way to help the fiatists that don't really understand Bitcoin see it as a store of value without a leak, as he talked about it, that stands up over time. And so that he can help those people, the less informed or knowledgeable about Bitcoin, kind of get their foot in the door. And that once they get their foot in the door, they can continue to explore it and end up at their own thesis, which makes sense to me as well. So I don't know for sure. You know, I have people that commented that have talked with him in person. Luke Royals was one of them and said, nah, he gets it. I was like, okay. I mean, there are valid points here, but ultimately I'm still confused. And it really made me extra confused when I heard him say, you use Bitcoin to back the dollar after the presentation. I was like, what's really going on here? So I'm kind of still in a state of confusion and trying to figure out what's going on. But nonetheless, he's done great things for the space. And as I commented, like, nobody fully understands Bitcoin, including me and anybody listening. And that's very important. And on the similar note, nobody is important to Bitcoin. Like, as in, Bitcoin doesn't need anybody. If Saylor disappeared, Bitcoin would still be Bitcoin. If I disappeared, if you disappeared, Bitcoin would still do. I think those things are all important to keep in perspective, but I still am absolutely confused on how Saylor truly sees Bitcoin in the long run. I know Safedean put a comment under his post, which was, it was discussing his price targets. I think it was, you know, 3 million, maybe 13 million and 45 million or 49 million were his price targets. And then Safedean was like, Michael, I didn't know you were so bullish on the dollar and for the next 21 years. I was like, yeah, I agree. I'm not bullish on the dollar. I don't care about Bitcoin's price in 2045. I just don't. So it's interesting. Yeah, that's a long-winded way to say I'm still confused.
Yeah, and it has always made sense to me, you know, people in different positions, the notion that he can't say everything that he might be thinking, it does hold water for me. Which is good, because I love what you said about we also need to speak the truth, and which is why I think conversations like these are great, because we can. And anyone can listen to this, and more people might listen to Saylor, but if more people listening to Saylor eventually trickles down to more people listening to stuff like this, then great. So yeah, I think, yeah, I want to say I agree with you. The notion that if there were in the future two widely recognized forms of money, and one of those two retained its value and the other did not, it's hard to imagine why people, unless they were absolutely held at gunpoint, would choose to use money door number two.
Right. Couldn't agree more. That's why Bitcoin wins, is because it retains its value and transfers its value the most effectively. Space scales and obviously time. And that is why Bitcoin, the first domino to fall in the three functions, is store value. And then it becomes the exchange and unit of account. But it's because people are like, this is the best place to store my money. And that's how I kind of got it. I got into it from the investing lens, and now I see it as savings, but it is the best place to store your money. And so as the market increasingly realizes that, which has happened over the last 15 years, then it just shifts towards Bitcoin being money.
And it's such an important point you're making there, I think, to just be aware that the Bitcoin price going up over time is a reflection of more and more people just choosing to store their money in Bitcoin. That's why that is exactly what's going on.
Precisely. It's not, I think it's the ultimate signal for Bitcoin's, you know, kind of signal of its own. It's like, if we didn't have the price, then we wouldn't really know the value of it. And the market is more intelligent than all of us. And so the market is telling you that Bitcoin is the best performing store value savings technology asset over the last 15 years since it's been adopted. Well, that's also the thesis, and the market backs that up, and the market is way smarter than you or I or anybody else. So if you're just listening to the market, well, it's already proved itself so far, and it's only gotten stronger as a network that's protecting what has made it such a strong store value. So I don't see how it's going away anytime soon.
And it's a force that predictably, you know, like the price target estimates in dollars over long periods of time are really just a reflection in the confidence of people's like ongoing desire for more money to be stored there. But I think, you know, and I think what you're getting at is that ignores that at some point people just, if they've already stored all their money in this other monetary network and enough other people have too, you know, it's like trying to phone somebody back who's texting you, like you're texting them and they're phoning you. At some point you're just going to have to, if everyone's texting, you're going to have to text.
Yeah. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of like, if everybody's just receiving dollars to put them immediately into Bitcoin, which is what I said in this Sailor post, well, then everyone's just going to say, well, just give me the Bitcoin. I don't want the dollars. And that's, you know, some people have already reached that point where like, I don't even want dollars. Don't even pay me dollars. I'm only taking my salary in Bitcoin. You know, you'll continue to see that adoption more and more over time.
Because I think too, it, you know, and this is the idea that more and more people are becoming quickly aware of, is how would you, you know, sanely store your money using a money system where they're continually making more of that money? Like, we, you know, when none of us had a choice before, it was, you know, nothing to really spend your time pondering. And of course, everybody did it. There was no other reasonable, you couldn't really move your wealth in and out of gold. Like somebody who was trying to live on a gold standard on their own in 1985 probably would have had a pretty hard time. But this is what's changing right now, and it's changing fast.
Very true. And it's exciting. You know, I had some conversations, and it's like, we're living through the adoption of Bitcoin, and we're living through the revolution, and we're part of it. That's something that was asked to me one time. The first Bitcoin meetup I ever went to, someone asked me why I was in Bitcoin. Was I in for the price gains and wealth? I said, the revolution. That's my answer, is destroying this fiat insanity and this nonsense and this evil, this great evil force basically has a knife up to all our throats. Anybody that's holding on to fiat currency. And so we destroy this beast and Phoenix rises from the ashes, and we're part of the monetary revolution that is Bitcoin. And that's a pretty cool and awesome time in history, all time history.
It's the most exciting time. And you and I share an opinion, which you've coined as a new renaissance on a Bitcoin standard. I like to call it a golden age of reason, but I think we're talking about the same thing. But I would love to talk to you a little bit about your idea of what a new renaissance on a Bitcoin standard might look like.
That's a big question. I've kind of adopted a new phrase, and I don't know if it'll stick in my head or not, but I kind of like the last renaissance, because it signals us figuring out money and the reason why we've gone kind of back and forth. You know, there's war and calamity outside, but we haven't figured out money. And so once you figure out money and you lay that bedrock of a foundation for the entire world and economy, then you're talking about, you know, something that can't really crack, something that you can always build on top of sturdily, like, because that is the ultimate foundation, is the monetary solution. So what does a new or last renaissance look like? I think certainly you see a shift in political space, because if the Bitcoin thesis plays out, you're talking about the separation of money and state. And because so much of governance, as we know it today, relies on their monetary monopoly and their ability to wield their money printer how they please, and the incentive structure that creates. Well, once that's eliminated, you're talking about a completely new model of governance, because they don't have control over the money. They can't enforce legal tender laws that then they can go print. And there's $35 trillion of debt. Talk about timestamping. In a month, it'll be $36 trillion, right? But it's this incentive structure, I think, is really the biggest thing that changes. And incentives are really what create the world that we live in. It's why Bitcoin works. It's why Bitcoin will work. It's why Bitcoin will adopt it, because people are incentivized to store their value as effectively as they can. And because Bitcoin does store their value as effectively as possible, people will shift to that. So from a political perspective, you're kind of incentivized right now, of course, to get elected, but you're also incentivized to play to the hand that prints the money, which is central banks and all of the people there. And so you see lobbying and you see special interest groups that are just trying to suck off the teeth of the government and their money printer. So once you eliminate that, you talk about, well, you know, the furthest extension, and I like thinking that governance will change to more of a private model in line with the sovereign individual thesis, to where they become for-profit entities. And it's why capitalism, true capitalism, is best, because for-profit creates an incentive structure to provide value. So if a government system model was for-profit and privatized, well, then they have an incentive to create value for whoever is living in their domain. Because if they don't, then they won't make any money and they'll go out of business. They'll lose their land, they'll lose their citizens, people will move, whatever. So as you separate money from state, you dissolve a lot of this power. And there's already private governance models that exist. I'm not sure how many people listening are aware, but there's a governance model called Prospera down in Roatan, the island of Roatan off the coast of Honduras. And they're a private entity. They have their own regulatory framework under the Special Economic Zone Charter of Honduran Law Code. And so they've literally created their own private zone on this island with their own regulatory framework, their own set of tax rules. They have, I think, one of the five lowest tax burdens in the world. And additionally, they don't have as many regulatory, because they have their own regulatory framework. And also you can create your own regulations and not just create it and just enact it yourself, but you can pitch it to them. And they say, okay, cool, this makes sense. And because they're for profit, because they're private, they're incentivized to take the things that bring as much business as possible. So they want to eliminate as many regulatory hurdles as possible. And so one thing that's really cool is the kind of pharmaceutical clinical trial industry has flocked to there, because in the United States, for example, it takes 10 years to run a clinical trial and get a drug to market. On Prospera, it takes 6 months. So that's right, an incentive right there. So already you're seeing prosperity flood there and you're seeing clinical trials and cool things happening. I actually stayed down there for a month at the start of this year to check it out and hang out with some people there. And it's a beautiful area on its own, but it's also just well run. And additionally, I visited they call it the Duna District there. So it's basically this mixed use area for living and co-working. There's commercial shops and there's a walkway to the Caribbean Ocean. And it's just a beautiful area, but they were under construction. This whole kind of multi-story, $3 billion, that's all interconnected, was under construction. And I'm down there in February checking it out. And they said, yeah, we're going to be done in May 2024. Well, anybody that's ever heard of government, like a road project or something, yeah, we're going to be finishing this up in summer of 2023. Well, it's not going to get finished until fall of 2020. So I just heard in May that they had completely finished the building. So they were on schedule. And it's because they have this incentive structure just to make money. They're for profit. Whereas you talk about something public, like let's give an example of restaurants and the incentive structure here. So there's two restaurants. There's one that pops up and it's private, for profit. They provide horrible food. Half of their patrons get food poisoning. Service is terrible. Logically, they're going to go out of business because no one's going to show up anymore. They don't want food poisoning. They don't want to get yelled at. That's a good thing. The market eliminated a bad restaurant. And it tells other people, well, this is the bar. You have to provide something better than this if you want to even have a chance of staying in. Well, let's say there's another restaurant, but this one is publicly funded. So they still provide terrible food and service is horrible. Half of the people get food poisoning. This is paid for by all the taxpayers in the area. They earn money. Okay, the tax goes to the government and the government funds the restaurant. So no matter how little people show up to this restaurant, the government will continue funding it with taxpayer dollars, which is horrible because this restaurant should not be in business because it's straight up a bad restaurant. And this is the case with schooling today. And schooling is another thing that gets fixed on this new last Renaissance golden age of reason, because it becomes privatized, because the government doesn't have as much money to use, and things become privatized and for profit, top down and bottom up. And so you see schools that then have an incentive structure to provide as good of an education as possible because they're for profit. And if they don't, they will go out of business. Whereas we have public schools today, like I was in for 12 years, in which I despised and which frankly didn't educate me all that great past some basic math and English and reading, all of those skills, but they're always going to be funded by the taxpayers. And, you know, you can get into what taxation is on a deeper level as well, but it doesn't matter how bad the education is. They're going to be funded because people pay taxes to the government and the government funds it. And it's also why teachers are criminally underpaid, because they're funded by public money and they only have so much money. They have 27,000 different projects at their work, including paying off a ridiculous amount of interest on their debt. And they still spend too much money. They still run a Ponzi scheme. But yeah, there's so many other things as well, but I'm just excited for the incentives that will finally be aligned with creating prosperity and value that comes with separating money and state, really fixing money.
Yeah, and I think about, for people who really haven't comprehended the fact that this money, Bitcoin, is borderless, what a significant thing that means for government's ability to not adapt over time. Because in the old money system, part of what separate currencies do is trap value inside a border. So you can move Canadian dollars into the US, but there is a process and there are things like AML and KYC that prevent you from, you know, transactions of a certain size. And it really is, these are like gates around moving monetary energy between political boundaries. And Bitcoin is something that entirely circumvents that old system of gatekeeping, because if someone is really unhappy enough with how things are running where they're living, they really just need to be able to physically get themselves out of that place and they can take whatever amount of money they want with them.
Yes. And that is so important. And that's why, I mean, that's why part of the reason why gold failed, because it was bound by the physical world and that a little bit earlier, but it's like the internet, right? I can send information over the internet to Canada. And Canada can send it to me. And it's basically like there aren't any borders on the internet. There's no countries and nations and territories and all this stuff. And it's not controlled by anybody. It's just a protocol. And we send information on that protocol. It's completely decentralized. Most people, including myself, don't really know the inner workings of how it operates and works, but it just works. We're listening to this podcast on the internet right now. Information is being transmuted across the internet constantly, all over the world, instantly. And so that's what Bitcoin is for money. It's transmitting money with no borders anywhere in the world instantly. And nobody can stop it. And it's not controlled by any central party. It's completely decentralized. And most people as well don't know the inner workings of it, but it just seems to work.
Yeah. You know, and you might disagree with me, but I think that it's like the Renaissance was happening already. And it's a result of the sort of confluence of all these information age technologies maturing, you know, and making these ideas and the spread of information possible. And Bitcoin just happens to be kind of the missing puzzle piece, right? It's the last part of porting all of the value from the old world into this digital world where we're heading, where information is already moving in a global way that is like, this has never happened before. So what was missing prior to that was a way to move value at the same speed as information. And that's what's so profound about this, how it can unlock a truly like a planetary way of thinking. Because I always talk about even just the absurdity of money working 167 different ways based on there being 167 different currencies. Like anybody who has spent their entire life interacting with the Venezuelan Bolivar just has a fundamentally different understanding of money and value and how governments should work relative to somebody who lives in the US. Like that's just true.
It's absolutely true. And I think when you talk about, I would first agree with you in that the Renaissance is already happening and Bitcoin is the key that's unlocking the infinite amount of prosperity awaiting us. And that I think once you really adopt those private governance models, that's kind of the hand that opens the door and opens the door. And I think that's what Bitcoin ultimately. Great. So I think that's an interesting perspective. And I think also if we had an actual, let's say Bitcoin actually existed 55 years ago or 100 years ago, well, then we would be living like kings. Productivity, obviously increasing at an exponential rate. We wouldn't be working 40-hour work weeks. People wouldn't have to be working more jobs. Life wouldn't be more expensive. And our value that we hold, that we earn and hold, our money would be going up in line with the increase in global productivity. So we would have a tool for savings. We wouldn't have to go out and invest it and risk it to maintain our value. And again, we'd be living like kings and queens out here. So it is the infinite prosperity is awaiting us, and Bitcoin is the key that gets us there.
And I think that, you know, to a certain degree, ideas unfold at the pace people are ready for them to happen. And like Henry Ford had the idea for an energy money replacing gold 110 years ago. But that idea was like, would have been so foreign at the time that probably barely any people alive would have been able to even comprehend what he was imagining. And even, you know, to continue along that line of thinking, like, yeah, I think a universally accessible hard money would have really made a huge difference for where we are now, but people probably weren't ready for understanding the concept. And part of the reason why I think this is happening is because it's really like we're crowdsourcing a fundamental shift globally in how people understand money and value. And it's made possible by things like YouTube and, you know, wherever else. And it's like, it's because what you were talking about with the education system, like this is an example of technology that's being decentralized in real time. So 50 years ago, everyone would have got all of their information from schools and then from the news and the newspaper, and everyone would have been reading the same newspaper. It would have been an event that happened one time a day. You know, it's like, so the flow of information ideas was also gatekept in the same way Canadian dollars today still are from flowing into the US. But this is like a almost like a waterfall effect of like an intellectual revolution where things are made possible. New ideas are made possible by the things that came before it and people's sort of collective evolution of understanding.
Yeah, I think that's so incredibly well said. And like I don't think money would have ever been solved without it being digital and leveraging the internet. And I think Bitcoin, you know, I learned about Bitcoin because of information being able to be spread in a decentralized manner mainly on Twitter. And then, you know, I heard about a book called The Bitcoin Standard. And then, okay. And I took it to the physical world and all sorts of this stuff happened. But I think, I like to think like if a presidential candidate, let's say Trump was like actually totally understanding of Bitcoin, wanted to separate money from state, eradicate the dollar and the Fed. Well, it might actually just be too soon and too sudden because we're just not there on a global scale yet. We're not even at 5% global adoption. And that number is probably high. To just eradicate the global reserve currency next year would just be pure chaos. And I don't know we had the infrastructure to do that. So everything happens in divinely perfect timing. We're part of that process.
Yeah. And I often feel like, you know, we live in such a kind of TikTok society where like things, our attention spans have been condensed to such short timeframes where people even now are debating Bitcoin as to like whether or not it's failed or working. And like, this is something that will unfold probably for like 1,000 years, you know, like it's going to continue to, if we're changing something that people have been doing. And I guess the thing I mean is like money being issued by an issuer. That's a pretty ingrained and entrenched concept in most people's minds. So that's not something that is probably likely to like just be a light switch thing where everyone wakes up one day and we're like, aha, we're doing Bitcoin now. And so it's not reasonable to even expect that.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I don't think, you know, as much as I want to vote for a candidate that actually does support those more hardcore beliefs and actually wants to separate money from state, it might just not be the time for that right now. And I think, you know, that candidate will arise in the perfect timing. And at the same time, Bitcoin doesn't need that. It'll happen regardless. So I don't really sweat it. And I've talked about it before, like, you know, as we talked about, Bitcoin doesn't need us.
doesn't need me. It doesn't need Satoshi. Obviously, he created it, but the creator of the thing vanished, and the thing has only gotten exponentially bigger since then. And so, you know, it doesn't need Saylor. It doesn't need Trump, but we do need Bitcoin. Trump does need Bitcoin. And yeah, we're seeing humanity wake up to that fact. But it's not going to, like, how can you get people in, you know, isolated parts of South America or Eastern Europe or Africa or Asia woken up to this fact? You know, it takes time. I think only 60% of the world uses the internet today, and that's been around much longer than Bitcoin. So it'll take time. And it'll be fascinating to see it play out. I do know that.
Maybe just to shift gears a little bit, there's something else I want to ask you about. You wrote an article a while ago talking about the seven deadly sins. And, you know, there's the ones people talk about more often, kind of greed and lust. And the article you wrote was actually about sloth, and that the idea that sloth may be the deadliest. Where did you come up with that idea? And Penny, for your thoughts on why?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up. It's a great topic because, listen, all of them are deadly. There's no doubt about it. They're called the deadly sins for a reason. But sloth, to me, you know, it's laziness, it's apathy, it's just being motionless. It's not doing anything. So if you were to live your life, and I actually saw a sloth in Roatan in Prospera, and those things, let me tell you, they move slow. Like, they slower than you'd think. Like, if you try to run a marathon as a sloth, you'd be there for maybe 3 millennia, like 3,000 years. It would take you that long. But sloth as a deadly sin for human nature is just not really doing anything. It's like, well, I want to go to the gym, but then you never go to the gym. Well, I want to write a book, but you never write. Well, you want to study whatever it is, but you never study. And so if you never actually did anything, you took it to the extreme and lived a life in complete solitude, didn't do anything, like, what would your life really be? You wouldn't hang out with friends. You wouldn't hang out with family. You wouldn't learn anything new. You'd just be sitting there motionless in this state of sloth. And you talk about greed and lust and gluttony and all these other ones. But to me, it's sloth. It's the deadliest, because life is dead when you're just not doing anything, sitting there. If you sat on a couch your whole life in sloth, how much life force would you be generated, and how much rewarding would life really be? How much of an experience and a journey would it really be? And so I took it to the ultimate extreme on the other end of, like, the David Goggins, and that's what I wrote about. And that's the cover of the article. Like, that guy is the opposite of sloth. Who's going to carry the boats? And he just talks about getting after it. And he's an example of somebody that does relentlessly, and it's inspiring to people and motivating to people. And you don't have to be a Goggins. You can, you know, everyone's got their own equation, but it's an example of, you know, you get out what you put in, really. And that guy's putting out a lot, and he's getting a lot back. And he's an example of how far kind of the human spirit can really go. That's what's so inspiring. But I'm glad you asked about that.
So what do you think about, you know, Bitcoin's role in the discussion of sloth as the deadliest sin?
What a good question. I think Bitcoin is a tool for freedom, ultimately. And freedom allows you to, especially monetarily, allows you to do the things that you love without worry about paying your bills or working another job or funding your kids' education, whatever it is. And because Bitcoin is a tool for savings, the ultimate tool for savings, and because, you know, ultimately down the line, it becomes the barometer for the increased global productivity, you can go up. I was on a podcast earlier today. We were talking about, you could go up to the mountain in Switzerland, take a 3-hour hike up there, pop yourself down, read a book, because productivity is increasing that entire time. The value of your money is, like, affords you the freedom to read the book, to take the hike, to enjoy the day in nature, and to come home, have a wonderful meal with family, travel the world, do whatever. So it actually takes the burden of life off, which leaves us exhausted and worn out. And then it leaves us with sloth on the things that we actually want to do, because we're expending more and more and more energy against this fiat system that's stealing our energy just to live and to maintain and to sustain ourselves and survive. And so when you have a tool for freedom, monetary freedom like Bitcoin, where you can plan for your future, you can save for your future, you know your value is going to increase, then you can actually get Goggins-esque about your passions and your curiosities and what really brings you joy, life force. And you can attack those things with life force without having that thought in the back of the head, well, what about those bills that I have to pay? And that's a huge tool. That's a huge paradigm shift in humanity. And, you know, it'll only get better and better as productivity exponentially increases. And it'll just allow us to reconnect with our true selves and our true things that we love doing. And that's, and time, like it gives us back our time as well. And I think that's just, it's priceless.
And the reason I ask, because I actually feel like these two subjects are really linked, the idea of sloth and the concept of the Renaissance. And here, I'm going to share you, this is my thought on it, is I think that time is the last penny to drop before we are truly ready for an intellectual transformation as a species. And it's because of exactly what you said, that nobody today has the time to really stop and smell the roses. And that's a problem that in the fiat world actually gets worse progressively forever. So our time is being confiscated, and the rate at which it's being confiscated is accelerating. And because of that, nobody really has the time to think about anything. And this is why we're a TikTok society. This is why people watch movies less now and watch episodes more, and why people like short form content and like truly in TikTok. If you haven't captured someone's attention within 7 seconds, they're going to flip to the next thing. So it's the intimate compression of time. And I think that once we have fixed that problem, like there's a collective massive exhale that's waiting for us where we can really assess things. And that's when I think true like cultural flourishing is possible.
Man, this got the devil's guys dropping the truth. That's so awesomely said, and I fully agree. And the only thing scarcer than Bitcoin is our time, and those are the two true scarce assets, and really the two things that I can be certain of are that I'm going to die, and that there's only 21 million Bitcoins. And to have your time actually stolen from you in the fiat system, which is what happens, is like holy crap. And you see these videos on TikTok and on the internet of people screaming against the machine, and like, why do I have to work another job just to make ends meet? Why does it seem like we're going backwards? Why is the world getting more violent, more hateful, more divided? And it's all because the money is broken and it's stealing your time and your energy. And you're having to claw back and fight back against it. And that's why I talk about Bitcoin so much and try to do the best I can to spread that awareness that there is a solution to this problem. There is a tool that actually grants us our time back. And not only that, it allows us to access more time in a sense and provides us with freedom so that it's literally working in reverse. It's like, oh, I have to work. I don't have to work as much now. I could still make the same amount of money. What would that world look like? Oh, I have to work. I only have to work less next year to make the same amount of money. That's completely different. And that is the reality in a deflationary world where things are getting that's expensive over time. Things are falling to the marginal cost of production, and you have a money, the tool for transferring value, that's increasing in value and increasing in purchasing power. It is a tool for savings and enables a low time preference, and just all of these things that are literally flipped on its head with fiat. It's why I think Bitcoin is the most important thing going on right now.
There isn't a close second, really. When you have understood what's going on, this is by far the most important thing happening in the world right now.
It's not much more than that. And I think once you get far enough into the rabbit hole, it's like, you know, you see so many Bitcoiners just dedicating so much life force to Bitcoin because they're like, this thing is just this black hole of truth and prosperity. And it's like, that's what I'm looking for. I can't really speak for anybody else, but why wouldn't the world be looking for that as well? And I say black holes of truth and prosperity, and that it funnels only truth and prosperity into it. And because it's built on truth, right? If you don't prove your work, there's no Bitcoins. And so the world is being built on proof of work. And that's a whole other conversation, but I'm here for it.
Yeah. You know, and the other underestimated aspect of the game theory around Bitcoin that I personally think is actually the most important piece is that people are intrinsically wired to hope for a brighter tomorrow. That's just true. It's true when you see people, like, you know, of all people anywhere in the world. And it's the most unstoppable thing about Bitcoin. When people understand that it is something that can make your future better, like this thing can magnetize everyone. It's just a matter of people understanding the idea.
It's so true. And even in the past year and a half of, like, you know, that's because my journey was stocks, and then I bought crypto, and sold everything in early 2022, learned about Bitcoin, spent the next 11 months in cash on the sidelines learning about it. And I was like, I'm all in. So I pushed my chips to the center in January 2023, and the price was in the low 20,000s. And so my purchasing power has increased basically 3x since then. Where if I kept all that money in dollars, it's gone down. And versus basically anything else, you know, the MicroStrategy and NVIDIA, but those are companies. Those are stocks. It's not a true tool for savings. And I can't go somewhere and pay somebody in MicroStrategy stock, nor can I with NVIDIA stock. But I say all that to say, it's like, well, I've actually earned more money just by holding on to something, and my purchasing power has increased. It's like getting a raise without working. How powerful is that?
Yeah, getting a raise forever. Cole, I really appreciated the, how you started this conversation in the sense of just talking about the truth, and what an awesome message that is. So thank you for coming on the show and sharing your ideas. And for our listeners, we will include a link to your profile on X, but is there anywhere else people can find you that you'd like to steer anyone to?
I'm out in the real world. You can find me there. I am somewhere. You know, you find me there, you find me there. But online wise, I'm just really on X. And yeah, that's where you can find me.
And if you're listening and you made it to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in. I appreciate your attention and so much, and hope to see you again next week.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Scott.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.